and welcome to a lock-in at the Crate and Crowbar. It's being recorded on the 11th of November 2021, and this week we're going to be talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And who is we? We is me, Marsh Davis, and he, Tom Francis.
Hello.
And leading us in this discussion is actual professional telly writer, Jamie Britton.
I mean, I don't know about professional, but...
Oh, welcome, Jamie, to this and many future lock-in podcasts.
Yes, hello. It's lovely to be here. I'm sort of such a long-time fan of this pod that I feel treading on hallowed ground, but hopefully I'm not too offensive to the ears of your listeners.
I think they're probably pretty bruised ears already. But let's just like, I mean, lay the groundwork for us, Jamie. What is space?
Whoa, we are really zoomed out.
Space is a place where TV shows happen. And one of those TV shows is the myriad and various forms of Star Trek. And as I was sort of involved with you guys talking about the various lock-ins that this might be. Tom mentioned that he was currently sort of box set binging Deep Space Nine, and I thought that would be a good thing to talk about because it's this kind of really sort of unusual show. It kind of comes at the sort of end of a particular iteration of Star Trek and is very much its own thing, sort of the weird cousin of the Next Generation. But I think, as we all agree, actually a really outstanding show in its own right. And kind of unique, actually, in both Star Trek canon and in sort of general media, really, in that it sort of starts as one show. It starts as your standard lads on a mission, plus token ladies, you know, escapades off into the beyond, and actually mutates into something else entirely, a kind of heavily serialized show about a big war and lots of big stuff going on that kind of brings a bunch of Star Trek elements such as god beings and genetically engineered soldiers and all those kind of sci-fi tropes to bear in something really quite operatic in scale. So yeah, I think there's lots to talk about and lots of interesting stuff to get into. We're going to be focusing in on a few episodes. I think we'll focus in specifically on Whispers, Duet, In the Pale Moonlight, and a few others probably. So I think we'll probably have spoilers mostly off, spoiler warnings sort of mostly off for this episode, and just kind of feel free to chat through anything and everything. I kind of wanted to kick things off, though, if it's okay, by asking you guys about your sort of Star Trek origin stories, because I think, you know, we're all white men of a certain age. Star Trek has featured in our lives to at least some degree, probably for quite a long time, and I'm very interested to kind of know where you guys came to it and how you got to how you sort of found Deep Space Nine along the way.
Yeah, for me, it was my only real memory of like Next Generation, like catching that casually on TV in pre-on-demand era, I just remember liking like the hiss of the doors. Like it was a very comforting like place to spend time. And I wasn't especially engaged with it. I didn't, despite being a big sci-fi fan and stuff, it wasn't like a favorite show or anything. It was just a thing that sometimes you catch it when it's on. The vibe of the spaceships was just really chill. And of course that fits well with their philosophy of no interpersonal drama, no conflict. Like everything is always a sort of scientific investigation. And I don't remember really clicking with it at all. And then Deep Space Nine, I think I initially had was even less interested in that because it didn't have the nice door hiss. Like they lost the core feature of Star Trek.
It's much more open plan, yeah.
Because it's not set on a Federation vessel. It's a Cardassian one, which is all kind of like ugly and metal and grey. But then I was watching. I remember my two like earliest memories of like actually taking an interest in this were one was just some episode in which Bashir and O'Brien are hanging out. I think I remember which one it is, actually. It's the one where they are curing a some kind of disease for some other species. And they end up getting trapped in a bunker together. And they just kind of bond over that. And I started to realize, like, this feels completely different to Next Generation because these guys are actually friends and everyone on Next Generation likes each other. They're all like, you know, broadly, you know, just nice to each other. But there aren't really any like strong friendships there. Like Data and Geordi is sort of one, but then Data's too weird for that to really feel like a human friendship. And everything else is just that they're just colleagues who have a lot of respect for each other and they're very nice. And just watching two people who like each other and hang out together casually as well made it, gave me that like human connection to it. And then I also remember an episode, which is much later in the series, called Rocks and Shoals, where they're stranded on a planet and there's a Dominion force there too. And it's a bit of a standoff where the Dominion's leader is sick and only the Deep Space Nine guys have a doctor. And so they sort of come to an uneasy arrangement in which the Dominion leader gets to screw them over, and he just does screw them over, and then it just ends. And I was like, what? You can just have it actually go the bad guy's way? And it, like, just that felt real and right for the story that they were telling. And so they just landed on that and it didn't have a happy ending. And that was like, really shocked me out of my casual viewing thing. Like, oh, this can actually like tell a story that, you know, is written that way and doesn't have to leave you feeling nice.
Yes, it's funny how much I sort of feel that the show kind of almost is kind of like the West Wing in a funny kind of way.
Yeah.
In that you have this kind of group of characters who are all broadly trying to do the right thing. And that is the kind of general tendency. But some of the stuff that kind of comes down the pipe to screw them over is really kind of sort of fundamentally terrible things that are happening to them, you know. And what you have as a kind of grounding for these characters is that kind of ultimate desire to do good. I wonder, you know, the fact that the two shows sort of share a theme tune. I mean, not really, but those kind of plaintive horns is something about that, isn't it? It's something about like, oh, you know, you're doing your best. You're doing your best in difficult circumstances. And that episode you just described is almost, you know, that is a West Wing episode where they're forced to care for an enemy's child. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the West Wing is, I think, the master of ending on a bad note, but still feeling sort of satisfying. Like you finish so many episodes of the West Wing end on a downer, but you still come away feeling like glad you watched it kind of thing.
I was really surprised rewatching these episodes, just how many of the Deep Space Nine episodes do end not only on a bum note, but sort of unresolved in a sort of way that feels very much like The Outer Limits or, you know, one of those completely self-enclosed, what are they called, anthologies. You know, the next episode won't necessarily pick up on those plot lines whatsoever, having ended in a really dark place. And I didn't have that recollection of the show at all.
No, it's interesting. And as they move into the sort of second sort of phase of the show, where it's all Dominion War all the time, they're relying less on kind of character beats to necessarily drive the story, which is kind of interesting in such a characterful show, because they're actually sort of doing something more kind of almost experimental and spreading plot across a series in an asymmetric way. So those character moments still arrive and they still happen, but they're less like in the same sort of rhythmic way of a TV show where it's like, well, we've all learned a lesson here at the end of this episode and we're going to reset a little bit, but not all the way. And it's really jarring when you don't see that. An episode I just watched, When It Rains, which is like the seventh episode from the end of the show, ends with this kind of devastating discovery about Odo and about what's been done to him. And it just ends. That's the end of the episode. And Odo sort of has learnt some of this, but not all. And it's really unusual because when you watch it, you see that like, oh, they're actually doing something. They're making very, very unusual choices here about how they pace their story and how they tell it. And it's really great.
A lot of this came from the fact that it was stationary because that was a big controversial thing. You know, there's a lot of internal conflict about whether can you do a Star Trek show that doesn't go somewhere, like it's going to just be in the same place the whole time.
Yeah, it doesn't track.
Yeah. Yeah. Star weight. They had a big internal conflict about this. And once they sort of got through it and settled on that, yes, they could do this. The thing they realized it freed them up to do was have consequences, because when something goes unresolved in one episode, it can come back. And that became their sort of method for moving things forward, was to have every episode can have consequences further down the line. And of course, that let them go further into serialization, which is a big internal conflict as well, about like the writers always wanted serialization and the studio didn't because it fucks with syndication. And Deep Space Nine is the time when they finally, slowly, eventually persuaded them to let them have more and more serialization.
Yes, and I want to come back to that point because it's funny. I was like, when I was watching this on Netflix, I wanted to watch random episodes. I was like, I want to watch a random episode of Deep Space Nine because there's loads. And the one, you know, Tom suggested at a sort of the cream of the crop, and I want to get a sort of good look at them. And Netflix doesn't have a built-in randomization button for episodes. It does for shows in general. You can fire up Netflix and say, show me something different, and it will show you something based on your viewing history randomly, so not entirely randomly. But it won't do that within a show because it doesn't serve the algorithm. Netflix wants you to start watching something and keep watching it forever. And it doesn't want you to jump back and forth through a show. And it's really interesting watching a show like Deep Space Nine, because even in the shows which are deep inside the Dominion War and are heavily serialized, there is enough of that ability to be self-contained, even in a really serialized story, that the show actually does perfectly support, you know, syndication, essentially, shuffling syndication. And there's a good website you can go on which will show you a random Star Trek episode. But Marsh, I wanted to ask you about your Trek origin story. Are you a child of the stars?
I am, yes. My dad was a big sci-fi fan and always watched Star Trek. And I just grew up watching it. I don't remember if I started watching it, you know, concurrent with its initial broadcast, or whether all of the episodes I watched were repeats. But I started certainly some way into The Next Generation. And occasionally watched earlier episodes from the original series and didn't gel with them as much for obvious reasons. They're much more kind of hammy and hokey. But at an age where I wasn't really able to kind of wield any sort of critical thought about it, it was just a cool story. But it became kind of an important part of sort of my childhood and like father-son bonding. And I think what Tom was saying about the sort of the chill atmosphere of those things, even though I wouldn't necessarily articulated that as something I liked about it at the time, I think it definitely is and remains the thing that I like about Star Trek, and even more so in Deep Space Nine, I think, which is out of the Treks that I watched, always my favorite. Again, for reasons that I couldn't really articulate back then, but having rewatched them, I think I have some idea of why I like it now. And with great relief, actually, that it wasn't a big old pile of shit, because that would have really wounded child me if I had gone back to it now and found it was rubbish. But then I fell out of love with it, with Voyager. And the Treks since then have been massive disappointments. And the recent kind of resurgence of Trek, I think, is pretty abysmal by contrast. It'd be interesting to get into what the differences are. But I did actually want to just jump back and ask, either of you a question, really, because Deep Space Nine, as we've discussed, is at this fulcrum between serialization and syndication, becoming a storyline which has more continuity. What was going on structurally in the industry at that time, which meant that having episodes syndicated became less interesting to the writers, or, you know, it was more viable to pitch serialized stories at that time? What was it that was changing then? Was syndication just dying a death in some way?
I mean, I don't know the particular history of it, really. I always assumed that they had Star Trek TNG, you know, nine series deep at that point, and they could kind of happily have that as their kind of syndicated show that would run and run, and it did run and run, as I'm sure you remember. And my assumption is that they were, because the creators of the show talk about wanting to make that shift pretty much from the start, from the off, and planting seeds for it for the whole Dominion War sort of really quite early on. And they were consciously deciding to sort of slowly shift the show into that space. And I wonder if it was because they wanted to define themselves against, you know, the next generation. Because, you know, the subsequent shows are all a different spaceship, you know, doing or one of the same spaceships just kind of trekking. And I think it's something to do with the thematics of a space station, you know. And that was obviously in the air at the time because there was Babylon 5, which is almost exactly contemporary with this year, which I've never seen, but I know has. I could never quite get past some of the ridiculous makeup and costumes I could see on that show. Like,
I wonder if part of it was that Deep Space Nine was just didn't have the limelight past a certain point. So the chronology was that Next Generation was first, obviously, and then Deep Space Nine was second. And then in the middle of Deep Space Nine's run, Next Generation ended and Voyager started. And so the writers have talked about how they felt kind of ignored and overlooked and underrated in a lot of ways because Next Gen got a big spike in attention when it ended and Voyager got a big spike in attention when it started. And Voyager was definitely like the golden child. Like that is what a lot of writers wanted to work on. That's what it got much better ratings. And it took attention away from DS9. And I wonder if they were just allowed to do the serialization just because the focus was less on them, the pressure was less on them to be the moneymaker. And so the studio just cared less about forcing them to make everything standalone.
Yes, I think also after a certain point, you get very good at making these shows and they worry less about kind of what you're doing. You know, finding out that each episode of Deep Space Nine was shot in 7 days at most, which is an extraordinary feat.
Wow.
And they do 24, 26 episodes per season, which just absolutely blows my mind how anyone gets that done. But it's funny because my personal origin story with Deep Space Nine is that, like, I was a big fan of the original series because similarly, my dad was big into it, you know, when he was watching it as a kid, and I used to enjoy watching those with him, and remember having nightmares because he told me about the episode with the flying jellyfish in them, which I still seen. They're quite ridiculous, but like still quite scary, that flying jellyfish episode of the original series. And then TNG, which I'd always kind of enjoyed too. But I remember watching the pilot episodes, part one and two, which are called Emissary of Deep Space Nine, and thinking, what the hell, you know, I must have been, I think it was on when I was 9 or 10 or something like that, and watching those and just almost consciously feeling that transformation of Star Trek from one thing to another, because the episode literally does that. It starts off with, you know, this guy, you know, suffering from the trauma of the loss of his wife as a kind of casualty of the Borg from battle that's happened, you know, in a previous episode of TNG, resentful at Picard and resentful at being stuck on this particular mission. And then the discovery of this wormhole and that being used as a kind of way to take this character into his own past and look at his own trauma and look at his own sort of reasons for being. And it's this incredibly emotional story where he is communing with these prophets, these beings who live inside the wormhole. And it's this really emotional episode of television, which is about trauma, and it's beautifully acted by Avery Brooks, you know, who's an amazing actor. And I remember just thinking, oh, I never knew like a Star Trek show could have themes like this, you know, things happening, characters suffering for their choices and being forced to make difficult decisions about who they are and what they believe in. And I remember thinking that was a kind of staggering, really brilliant pilot. And I know from doing a bit of reading that everyone thought it was a great pilot. And then for the whole of the first series, they couldn't quite work out how to recreate the feeling of it in the sort of normal episodes that they did. So is it worth now talking about some episodes in particular?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was I wanted to talk maybe just slightly briefly about the episode Duet, which I think it was the first one I watched on this recent rewatch. And that is the episode that concerns, this is from the Wikipedia synopsis, a Cardassian man arrives on the station suffering from an illness that he could have only contracted at a Bajoran labor camp during the occupation. Major Kira leaves an investigation to determine whether he is actually a notorious war criminal. And again, this episode is an astounding piece of writing, I thought, dealing with, you know, the the after effects of a terrible occupation and a terrible act of violence, and this character who's presenting himself as this monster, and then his ultimate reasons for doing that. And it's just, I mean, I'll let you guys talk about it, but I just thought it was sort of extraordinarily sensitive and really leaning into the complexity of an issue rather than the simplicity of it.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that I never managed to rekindle the fire of the first of the pilot episodes, but I do think that there's at least a couple of episodes in the first season which are, you know, superb, great economical treatises on forgiveness and self-forgiveness and truth and reconciliation, and really, I mean, tangled deep problems of humanity, and it's surprising to see them emerge from a show with a lot of prosthetics and hissing doors
not enough hissing doors.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I mean, it is extraordinary to be like, right, this is Star Trek. What we're going to do? Let's do the story of space Israel and space Palestine.
Right. I do think the Next Generation, I mean, one of the reasons that I love Trek and particularly the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine is that they both are quite outward looking shows. They're using allegory to talk about issues of the moment, and they are not afraid to deal with thorny issues and have their characters be the stand-ins for the most reasoned possible minds approaching these problems. And I think that's a really admirable setup for a show. There's such rich pickings from having your characters sort of attack difficult issues with the highest possible kind of ideals. I think the Federation is sort of like just a symbolic sort of exponent in these series of good. And I think it becomes less useful as a sort of means of solving these sort of quandaries as the Federation becomes more tarnished. And I think that's a difference between now and then. But because the most recent shows sort of are quite happy to show the Federation as being wholly corrupt, and I just don't think that's as interesting in a way as the premise for the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, where you have characters who are essentially stand-ins for all that is good, and they may have their own human foibles and difficulties in overcoming these problems, but you get a kind of best case scenario for approaching these issues.
Yeah, it's been a little longer since I saw Duet. I don't remember. The bit I remember is the duet part, which is Kira and this prisoner trying to figure each other out. But is there like a B plot? Is there like an action element to this episode, or is it all just like a play?
I feel like the whole episode is A plot, actually.
Right.
There is some stuff with Dr. Bashir kind of talking to Gal Dukat and trying to work out sort of who this person is. But it's actually mostly an A plot about these two characters kind of going up against each other.
Because the thing that's amazing about it to me is just how compelling it makes that. Like it doesn't feel like a constrained episode, or it doesn't feel you're not looking at your watch, you're not waiting for these monologues to end, because it manages to pace it as a mystery that's unfolding. There's what appears to be the case is immediately overturned. It cannot actually be true that he is this this war criminal, and that raises an even more intriguing mystery, which is why the hell would anyone claim to be this guy if they're not? And the way it unfolded that was so well paced and just gripping, and all while dealing with these really interesting issues and drawing more out of Kira, because Kira's such a good character. The fact that she brings all this baggage and this trauma and history and personal connection to the Bajor Cardassia situation, but is also in this kind of compromised position of being subordinate to a Federation captain or commander, as it was then, that she has to forever be torn between her, you know, most idealistic wants and her duties in that role is very juicy Star Trek stuff. Or maybe it's not actually typically Star Trek, because usually Star Trek, everyone's just Federation and sort of has united loyalties. But yeah, there's so much to that character, and this episode lets them dig into it really well.
Well, there's several scenes I saw with her where she sort of says, this is what I think about something, this is how I feel about something. And then someone says, but maybe that's because, you know, you're carrying this sort of resentment from this. And instead of what, you know, a lesser writer, a lesser show would do is have her kick back against that violently. She takes it upon herself and listens to them and engages with the notion that she might be wrong about her own feelings or how she's expressing her own feelings. And again, that just, that seems so refreshing to see, because characters tend not to do that on television. It's hard to write that. It's hard to play it. But she seems someone who is constantly, you know, in the grip of that. And of course, this episode, when you find out who this guy actually is, and he was this clerk who has been, who kind of is desperate to be, you know, for the Cardassians to be held account for the stuff that happened while he was working at this camp, you know, thematically, that is what the episode is. It's about, you know, it's about, you know, how you're, you know, how your feelings can be wrong, how your feelings about some of the worst things in the world can kind of break you as a human being.
Yeah, I love that twist. I love it. I love that character and his sort of breakdown when it all finally comes out. So if I'm remembering correctly, he gets killed at the end, right?
Yeah, it's one of the kind of great downbeat endings of the show. Yeah. It's almost a bit sort of like, you know, forget it, Jack, it's Bajor Town. It's like the guy gets stabbed and Kira kind of looks up at the camera and goes, no, and then it just cuts. And
yeah.
Then,
you know. So that's because I remember just feeling that was actually like a beat too far for me. Like it was, I didn't hate it, but I felt like I didn't need it. Like it was already ending so well at that point, like that revelation, it was already fucking tragic and heartbreaking, and then having him killed as well felt like it was a bit over egging the pudding.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, like those kind of some non sequitur sort of bum notes in this. But you know, is it Nana visitor?
I don't know.
Nana.
I looked up her saying it to check.
Oh, it is okay. Right. Okay. Yeah. Nana visitor is superb in this. I was interested to hear you talk about the acting in this and how the conventions have changed across the different checks, but there's a definite sort of like staginess, I would say, to the actors in DS9 and earlier treks. But I think it's sort of like an aesthetic rather than a limitation, because I think if you had characters who are sort of less mannered and sort of more natural, it would sort of root your engagement more in the dramatic moment rather than the kind of the drama of ideas, which is really what these shows are about. Like, I mean, you care about the characters and how they feel almost through attrition, really. But like, they're really just mostly conduits for an idea to be unpicked across the course of an episode. And although, you know, like you say, Kira has this conflict within her that she resolves in a convincing way. Like, it's almost not necessary that she has that internal life that she fights against these things on screen. She doesn't need to do that because her job there really is to kind of execute the unpicking of an idea. And I wonder if Star Trek really needs good actors in that sense. I mean, that's why Colm Meaney is allowed to be on it, I guess. despite all that, like despite whether, you know, that Star Trek needs good actors or not, like Nana Visitor is obviously a really good actor. Like she gets to shake with pent up emotion and have her eyes glisten wetly. But that acting never kind of obscures what is like the steady methodical task of the episode, which is to deal with this idea of guilt and recrimination.
Yeah, she's fantastic throughout. I think it's actually a very difficult role because you have to show pain and anger and trauma and stuff, but she manages to also make it a really likable character and a really like fun character and just very, you know, human and warm as well.
Yeah, she never just seems like a humorless hard ass. She seems, you know, properly human, even though she's not.
Yeah, which I think is a credit to the writing as well, because obviously if you wrote it a certain way, she would have no scope to do that. I'm glad that this character wasn't relegated to be like, you're only here to express the anger and trauma and and basically, you know, make everyone take it more seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, actually, we won't go into it in too much detail, but another one of the episodes I recommended was Shakaar, which kicks off quite a long-running thread of her and her former fellow resistance fighters, including Shakaar, which puts her in a role of trying to sort of talk them down from more extreme action. And that's another really interesting, I mean, when you have a character like this, there's so many different ringers you can put them through, all of which bring out different things and all of which are, you know, emotional and engaging. And her having to be the moderate and rein in her former colleagues was, really impactful and just a fascinating. I just found the episode like completely, just felt very fair-minded and very sort of earnest and just wanted to examine this issue just even-handedly and look at it, every side of it.
What also I liked about that episode is the B plot, which is Chief O'Brien is on a roll with his darts game.
Yes,
yeah.
I think it's my favourite A plot B plot split, just because all of Bajor is in turmoil, like it's on brink of civil war. The other thing is O'Brien's doing real well at darts, and then he hurts his arm. Oh damn!
I also really like the space darts board that they're using in Quark's bar. Is just the crap like electronic darts boards that you get in like rubbish pubs in the north of England. I noticed in that episode, and she was basically a new character to me because I haven't watched the show for so long. But Win Adami, am I pronouncing that right? Played by Louise Fletcher, who I was like, who is that? Where do I recognize her from? And she's Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
Which is, you know, one of the best movie villains ever, I think. And again, in Deep Space Nine, she's through the show throughout, you know, watching some of the later episodes where she's kind of being possessed by space ghost demons and stuff like that. She's in it for the long haul. And again, she's sort of playing space Yasser Arafat, I guess. And she's or something like that. And again, she just brings so much nuance to the character, you know, even though she's a villain in that episode and kind of a kind of very morally tricky person throughout the show. It's just such a great performance that she throws everything into.
I think DS9 does have the best villains out of all the Treks. And I think it is because it has that static premise that, and you know, you get to see these resentments build up over time and consequences roll on and on. And Win, what's her surname? Sorry. I have Kai Win written down here, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I just call her Kai Win.
Yeah, but yes, I mean, not only does it have the best villains, but it also has amazing episodes in which they get to eat shit. And, you know, it's really good to see her get her comeuppance, or Gold Dukat, who's, you know, the Cardassian ex-supervisor of the station, who's this just swaggering, pompous bastard of a guy, but not that
he's
bright.
So
and so he, you know, he comes a cropper. And Kai Winn, just so venal and, you know, petty and cruel, but all of that cruelty disguised by sanctimony. You know, it's just a superb piece of writing. It must be observed from life as well. Like it's a real human evil.
The writers talked about this. So all of the behind the scenes stuff I have said and will say comes from this book, The 50-Year Mission. It's a two-part thing. What the first part is about the original series, and the second part is about Next Gen and Deep Space Nine and all this. And apparently on Deep Space Nine, one of the reason that comes about, the reason it has such good villains is because them being a static location again, let them just get in guest stars. And then if they like the guest star, they just bring them back because it makes perfect sense that they'd still be around. And so they just got to cherry pick, basically. You know, Star Trek has always had a whole bunch of guest stars every episode. And with them, they just got to, if they like the actor, if the performance came off really well, then they just like, let's have them back in a couple of episodes. And so that created all these long-running villains.
Yeah, which is kind of unprecedented in TV, really. Like, even in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you wouldn't get, you know, they would often be in for a series and back for a cameo, you know, a couple of seasons down the line. It's really wonderful to be able to track people through like that. And they go through all sorts of matches, you know, watching an episode from right at the end of the show and look and seeing what she's up to now. It's like, wow, you really gonna... You're shagging Dukat and you're trying to summon ghosts from the demon dimension. he's in a different body now. It's all very, you know.
I'm quite looking forward to getting to that because, I'm on my current rewatch is in the middle of season six, but I have seen all of it several times in the past. And I remember the broad strokes of that plot line. But definitely this run through has really made me appreciate how good Mark Alamo is as Gul Dukat. He's like, I like that character, but especially that performance is so fucking slithering and... Like, but also well-rounded. He's not like a cartoon villain where he's just nasty all the time. He's got, it really gets into like, not just that he has an ego, but what particular shape that ego takes, like which things really set him off and which things he cannot do without. Like he has to believe that he is a good leader. He has to believe that that you know he's powerful. And again, this will be another quick episode shout out. But the episode Civil Defense, I put that on my list of recommended episodes just for
that's
one
a good
moment.
Shit-eating episode.
Yeah, shit eating. When you said shit eating, that is what I thought of, because the whole thing that makes that episode work is the broad premise is Deep Space Nine, because it used to be a Cardassian station, they accidentally trigger a security protocol where the station locks down and it thinks the Bajoran workers have rebelled and tried to take it over, which is sort of broad strokes kind of has happened triggers all these automated defenses. So they're all trapped there. And the only person who can save them is Gul Dukat, who shows up and of course lords it over them. And in fact goes further than even I was expecting in that he holds them to ransom and says he won't let them out unless they, I can't remember what the demands are, but agree to some political demands. And then as he tries to teleport out after leaving them with his demands, his teleporter doesn't work. And then a message comes from the Cardassian premier saying, "Ah, Dukat, I see you're trying to flee in terror now that the Bajorans have taken over the station. So I've disabled your teleporter. I've also removed you from all of the security overrides. So now you're treated just as another rebel and the station will self-destruct. It cannot be aborted. And all that's left for you is to dwell on your utter failure." And it's so perfect because it's like not just comeuppance, but it's extremely poetic comeuppance because it's the very mechanism that he was just using to leverage his power. And it happens in front of just everyone. Like he's actually in a private conversation and he walks back out in front of everybody to teleport away, which is probably just the writers wanting it to be extra humiliating for him, but also makes character sense because he would want to, you know, let them all see him escape to safety, and then just has the most public humiliation. It's just absolutely eviscerated in front of everybody. And Marco Limo, I didn't really like clock this the first time I watched it, but I went back and rewatched it just to get the details of that moment right this morning. And his little character choices that there, he like sort of bobs up and down on his toes and kind of claps his hands together. And it's just kind of like, he just doesn't know what to do with his body. That's so good.
Yeah, it's a good, great episode that. It's kind of Computer Says No, the movie, isn't it? It's kind of...
yeah.
Tom, shall we talk about, I know because this is one of the ones that you were sort of most into talking about, Whispers. Classic episode,
yes.
Whispers.
Yeah, Whispers and In the Pale Moonlight are my two favorite Star Trek episodes of any series or season or show or whatever you want to call it, and probably two of my favorite hours of sci-fi at all. And Whispers especially is just a perfect standalone. You can watch Whispers without knowing anything about the show. Actually, there is one element of it works especially well if you have been following the show, but it is an episode of one of the most overused formats in Star Trek, which is some of the crew are acting strangely. that is the premise for so many episodes of Star Trek. And it's almost always some fucking gas, some fucking like weird nebula thing they're inside of, or like a parasite has got into people, or...
don't forget God beings. You know, you're never too far from a God being.
God beings could be controlling them. They could be holograms. So many sort of just tropey explanations for it. And this one... First of all, it's really well told. Actually, if you look at these two episodes, you will immediately understand my extremely simplistic tastes, which is anything that starts with, "Well, I guess it all started about last week or 10 days ago." I'm immediately on the edge of my seat. I'm like, yes, yes, what is this? anything told in retrospect is catnip to me. And so it's Miles O'Brien recounting the strange behavior of certain crew members and people just kind of shutting him out. And it feels like they're all kind of conspiring against him. And it seems to affect more and more people. And he's very concerned about this. And he goes to Odo about it. And Odo is sympathetic. And it's got this really nice, until then, everyone, even his wife, he's suspicious of. And he's had just no friends. And when he tells Odo, Odo's like, "Oh my God, this is terrible. Like, leave this with me. I'm going to look into this. It's definitely very serious. Thank you for, you know, telling me." And it's such a moment of like relief and comfort, and you like love Odo in that moment, like, oh, thank you, someone is on his side. And also, it makes perfect sense because every one of those, well, almost every one of those explanations for weird crew behavior wouldn't work on Odo because Odo is not human. He's not anything like any of the humanoid species. He's completely fucking clay inside or whatever. So it makes perfect sense that he's the one not affected. And then a few scenes later, he is also shutting O'Brien out. He's completely on board with the conspirators and has switched sides. And it's absolutely crushing because it's just like, what the hell is going on? Like what could possibly be affecting Odo as well? And then, of course, the final twist of the episode is the reveal that they do a good job. It's a bit schlocky, but they do build it up really well, where he flies out to this remote asteroid and finds a secret base, and Sisko and Kira are there, and some aliens, and they're just saying, like, please just let us open this door. Everything, what's behind this door will explain everything to you. And weirdly, just one of the aliens just shoots him. He doesn't really, I couldn't remember how he got taken out. So I rewatched that this morning as well. One of the aliens just shoots him for no real reason. He does have a gun at them. So it's like a tense situation, but there's no actual like straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing. And as he lies dying, the real O'Brien steps out from behind that door and is marveling at the authenticity of the replica, and they reflect that, you know, even he didn't know he wasn't the real O'Brien. And so basically the guy who's been acting strangely the whole time is our point of view character, and the conspiracy was them all knowing that he wasn't the real O'Brien and had been replaced in order to do something to do with, there's some negotiations happening, highly sensitive meeting happening on DS9, and he was there to sabotage it and, you know, presumably assassinate somebody. But yeah, that turning it all on its head, it's so brutal, it's so chilling, and it's just such a nice twist. I genuinely didn't see it coming, and it lands so well.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and testament to Colm Meaney's excellent sort of acting stressed. I read that subsequent to this episode, there is a whole sort of mini-series within the show of Chief O'Brien has a stressful day kind of
episodes. Yeah. They absolutely destroy that man. They, like, every opportunity they find, they take to absolutely brutalize him and ruin his life. And there's one where he just commits like a sort of unwittingly breaks a law on a certain planet. They put him in jail, but like a special kind of magic time jail where he experiences 20 years of solitary confinement. Oh, God. They just break his mind.
Yeah, Colm Meaney, what a guy. It's so funny because I also watched one of the randomizer episodes I watched was Our Man Bashir, which is this kind of ridiculous holodeck episode, holodeck malfunctioning episode, which features everyone playing kind of Bond characters and Bond villains. It's actually really good and really fun and really silly in a good way, and actually has some great Garak and Bashir stuff. But when Colm Meaney turns up, he's just got an eye patch on and is otherwise unchanged.
He's a very curious performance, O'Brien, because in certain respects he's a very compelling performance. When he's being like convivial, I think he's very convincing, and when he's being pissed off, he's very convincing. But like if he needs to do anything, like I mean, it takes him like a 3-second wind up to raise an eyebrow in surprise. It's sort of hammy, but it kind of. I have a great deal of affection for him and the character as a result.
It's really interesting. There's an episode called Far Beyond the Stars where Sisko is imagining them all as writers in the 50s. And so everyone, all the regulars are in there, but they're out of makeup and playing different characters with different personalities. And it's very interesting to see who can do that and who can't. Colm Meaney is one of the ones who can't, I'm afraid. Like he's given a very broad character to play, so that might be partly to blame. But he's supposed to be sort of just someone with a stutter who's obsessed with robots and a bit of a weirdo. But he plays it in a very kind of hammy, like not very convincing way. It's really awkward.
But going back to Whispers itself, I also think one of the really clever ways that it uses that structure to its benefit is by that excellent, as you say, Tom Nip structure of starting in the middle and saying this just happened a few moments ago. But then after a certain point, the episode catches up with himself and he's in the wormhole. And there's only like 5 minutes left of the episode, if that, and it still hasn't resolved. And there hasn't been a part one in the credits, so you know that this is about to resolve in some way, but it hasn't got enough time to do anything with any kind of sense. And so it makes you feel really anxious, especially if you're watching on Netflix and you can see the bar going to one end. And I'd never seen this episode before. I didn't know the twist. And then the fact that they do manage to resolve it and twist it and end the episode on this like brutal downbeat where the cloned version of O'Brien asks him to tell his wife that he loves her, you know, it's incredibly effective. And really comes out of nowhere and is a wonderful use of kind of pacing to throw you off.
I think what's so chilling about the ending is that all these characters who you otherwise love show very, very little empathy with clone O'Brien. I mean, they're obviously not delighted that he just got fucking shot for no reason, but like they're just like, oh, well, sucks to be a clone, I guess. And it's, you're like, well, I mean, it was a clone who was identical to the person you're friends with. So surely you'd be able to extend some kind of feeling towards it and its existence and its, you know, sense of identity. But no. And then the episode just ends, and it's
it just really rams home the coldness, doesn't it? Like that's the what they want you to feel at that moment, having been rooting for this guy the whole way through. We've got to just realize that there's no redemption coming from him. He's never going to be friends with these people. All of that conspiracy, that fog, whatever you want to call the thing controlling everybody to resent him, is never going away, because that was the real them. I do, now that you mention it, I do want to know if O'Brien did go home and tell Keiko that fake O'Brien loved her. By the way, you've been hanging out with her. She already knows, actually, doesn't she? That's why she's treating him weirdly. She's had to.
Yeah, because he chose to get it on with her. He chose to start some romance. God,
yeah, I've forgotten that.
Which would be really creepy to be on the receiving end of.
Yep. Jesus.
It's funny that ending though, because I watched another randomized episode I watched with the Star Trek randomizer, which was called Sons of Morg, which is a Worf-centric episode. I love Worf so much.
It's a great episode.
I love Michael Dorn so much. He does so much under so much makeup, and I will I will state forever that his moment in First Contact, where Picard calls him a coward, and he stares him down and says, "If you were any other man, I would kill you where you stand," is my favorite bit of Star Trek ever.
Wow.
But it's so good. It's so badass. But Sons of Morg, the episode, which involves Worf's brother coming back to Deep Space Nine and basically asking Worf to kill him because Worf's defection from Klingon authority has brought dishonor on the family. It's an amazing episode, and Tony Todd, the Candyman himself, plays Worf's brother. A really amazing performance. But at the end of the episode, Worf decides that the only way to save his brother is to wipe his memory and give him to a new dad. He's like, "I've got this relative
Jesus.
Who will take him on as his son. So, and he won't remember anything about who he was, and we'll just pretend he was in a crash and he can sort of start a new life with this new dad." And like Bashir is like, "Are you sure we're going to do this? This feels extreme." And Worf's like, "Yes." And at the end, and then that's the end of the episode. And his brother sort of wanders off with this new guy. And it's like, that's a lot. That feels like a lot of, you know, it's weird to say, "Oh, I don't agree in assisted, you know, suicide." What I agree in is like wiping their memory and changing their identity. It was quite uncomfortable about it.
I really enjoyed this episode, and it is the solution is a terrible one. Like, it makes absolutely no sense. The idea that, I mean, it's sort of proposed to Worf by Dax in this scene where she doesn't actually explicitly says it. She's sort of like, "I've got a cunning plan, ... And then it's revealed what this cunning plan is. Like, they've received a dressing down from Sisko for Worf, you know, trying to kill his brother consensually in this Klingon ritual, which would preserve his honor and make him go to the afterlife and all this stuff. And obviously that doesn't work out. Sisko's very angry. He's like, "Not on this station." But Sisko's totally okay with him with, you know, essentially rehypnoling his brother into a completely different identity. I mean, it doesn't make a great deal of sense. But Tony Todd is fucking great in it.
Yes, and I'm told he also plays sort of an elderly Jake Sisto in the sort of No Dry House, I.I.'s Left in the House episode.
Yeah.
I think called The Visitor, which I'm told is amazing. Another thing I'd say about Sisko in that scene is like, he is so terrifying when he's bollocking Worf.
Yeah.
Like, really, really, I do not want to be bollocked by that guy. He is scary.
Can we talk about Worf a little bit? Because I feel like he is such an interesting character. And I don't really recall... I mean, obviously, he's in the Next Generation as well. So I guess he's already sort of locked in. But it struck me what a weird character he is. Within the fiction of Star Trek, like, he's extraordinarily odd for a Klingon. Like, whereas, you know, you had Spock in the original series, who is also caught between the two worlds, his Vulcan life and his life as part of the Federation. But like, unlike Spock, I think Worf's weirdness is not just a product of him being this liminal character between two worlds. He's just a weird fucking dude. Like, there's nothing about his dual identity that should make him really uptight and kind of find it very difficult to see other people's sense of humor. Like, none of the other Klingons are like that. They're always cackling and slapping their thighs and calling for more blood wine.
Yeah, I think I like that he's not just a mishmash of the two identities, and I especially like that he's not just the Klingon guy on the bridge, you know, representing here's what Klingons are like and here's how they do things. It's actually, it almost feels like a bit of a fake out. Or I don't know, you spend so much more time with Worf than you do with any other Klingon that you start to think that is what Klingons are like. And then it's only when they actually have a Klingon episode that you're reminded, oh wait, no, Klingons aren't like Worf at all. it's cool because it makes it his own personality. The fact that he drinks prune juice exclusively, I don't know if that has an origin story somewhere that I've missed, but that also is not particularly a human trait or a Klingon trait. I guess more human than Klingon, but he's interesting. I think that this obviously is not the real reason. I'm sure the real reason that he arrived on Deep Space Nine is because he was available and they wanted someone from Next Gen. But in my head, I like to think that they wanted him for Deep Space Nine because he has that dual role and he is split between two different loyalties, because Deep Space Nine has a lot of that going on. You know, Sisko right from the off, Starfleet officer who immediately becomes an important religious figure in Bajoran culture, and from then on has to try and balance that identity with his Federation One. Kira obviously is a, you know, resistance fighter who's now having to be part of this civilian militia and also be subordinate to a Federation captain. Dax obviously has all these different lives that she's lived and tries to be true to them all at the same time. Odo is, you know, initially balancing being part of a Bajoran security officer versus a completely unknown weird gel weirdo. and then as the series develops, takes on a completely new role and a new identity and as part of the Dominion, where he's sort of a god to their enemies, which is a totally wild position to be in. And then Worf just feels like he fits right in with that, where he's, you know, split between Klingon and Federation, but also, as you say, like, his real personality doesn't seem to come from either. So there's almost like a third, like, it's like he has a sort of code that he has to adhere to as well that doesn't fit with either.
Also quite a lot of, like, sex machine stuff as well. Like, he becomes sort of a kind of Rasputin figure in how much he's sort of romancing the various women of, like, every time you tune into Star Trek, he's got a different lady that he's managed to kind of cuck from out from under one of the other guys. And it's, you know,
I don't remember a lot of this. Is this in Next Gen or Deep Space Nine?
Well, in Next Gen, he definitely becomes a bit more of a sex machine towards the end of that, and he ends up with Troy. Troy ends up with him rather than Riker. And then just when I was turning on, you know, Sons of More, he's having some sexy backlair combat with Dax.
So that is a long-running thread and becomes a big thing. But in that, so I just watched a few episodes that focus on that, and he's extremely sort of conservative and chaste and just sort of obsessively monogamous, you know, that they go to a pleasure planet together, and obviously this is just a conflict factory for for him. But he just sort of, like, disapproves of anyone really enjoying themselves at all in that episode, and basically signs up to become a Republican. And so it's interesting that he's also been a total horn dog.
Well, I guess it's more that he's just irresistible. That is completely irresistible to anyone, any female apparently, who steps into his orbit.
He can't make it with Quark's wife, though. Quark is married to a Klingon, and Worf has a huge crush on her, but because he's not from an honorable house, she has no interest in him.
There's an early bit in like the first series of Star Trek where he tells, I think, Tasha Yar that he can't have sex with human women because he'd sort of tear them to pieces. presumably in the intervening years, he's learned to calm himself down a bit and mellow himself out a little bit more. Because he does plenty of that now. Sorry, I made it weird.
No, it was already weird.
Shall we talk about In the Pale Moonlight?
Yeah.
Or as I like to call it, Dark Space Sex and the City, with Sisko writing his article about how he's going to assassinate a diplomatically immune person.
Again, told in retrospect, immediately has me on the hook. It is the starting point is that there, all these casualty reports are coming in from the Dominion War. This is pretty deep in season six. So we're deep into there being an all-out war with Dominion and not just the Federation, but like the whole Alpha Quadrant, basically. And it's going very badly. And he is getting sick of having to, you know, tell people their loved ones have died. And so he's looking for a way to bring the Romulans into the war, because the Romulans are not participating right now because they have a treaty. Sisko argues that once the Dominion are done with the rest of the Alpha Quadrant, they're definitely going to come after the Romulans. And so it's both in the Federation's interest and in the Romulans' interest to bring them into the war. And he wants to find a way to do it. Now I can't remember. I think they go looking for evidence, right? They try and find, can we somehow prove that the Dominion are going to betray the Romulans? And it's established that that's impossible. I think, is that why they go to Garak in the first place, to ask him, like, how would we break into this and get eyes on this meeting to get proof of this? And he says, it just can't be done. Is that right?
Yes. And then he basically, Garak is the one who kind of slippy slides him into, all out fakery.
Yeah, this is. I was surprised to see how deep into the series it is, because in my mind, this is the Garak episode. This is where you find out who Garak really is, because Garak is a tailor on the station who is also a spy, which feels like a Le Carre nod. And he is forever, is mercurial the word? He just sort of changes who he is depending on the situation. And even when he reveals his spy history, even that might turn out to be a lie. You know, might find out he's actually making up a lot of that as well. So it's the fact that he's a spy is obvious from pretty early on. And there's a bunch of episodes about him. He and Bashir in particular have a great relationship. But I feel like this is the one where you get like, I guess it's just the version of Garak I like the most, which is he suggests we could fake the evidence. And, I know a guy who can make this holo recording, and I know there's a real particular kind of MacGuffin to do with like a Cardassian memory stick that they can only be recorded on once, and that somehow proves that it cannot possibly be fake, which is obviously not the case, because they're about to fake something and put it on there. I think they're about to demonstrate why simply having a one-use memory stick doesn't prove that something is genuine. But anyway, supposedly there's something that makes them extra believable. They go about faking this recording, and it's as you say, it's a slippery slope for Sisko. His narration is always going over, you know, was this the moment that I crossed the line? Was this the moment that I crossed the line?
He bribes Quark at one moment, just gives him everything he needs, which is brutal.
And then agrees to like supply some like bioweapons to the forger. The forger wants, he can't be paid in money, he's going to go with some bioweapons. And there's actually, I really like the moment between Sisko and Bashir, where Bashir's like, I can't give you that. That's fucking, restricted for one thing. I'm not allowed to, authorization wise. And also there's no good reason you could want this. Sisko forces him to, and he just like has this real like frosty, okay, well, I'm going on the record with my objection of this, and gets it from him. I think that was probably the line, in my personal opinion. Once you're securing the bioweapons for the terrorists, probably that was where you should have stopped. It involves getting this evidence and then getting it to a certain Romulan senator who is, you know, that if we can convince him, the whole council will follow. And Jamie, I think you had the same highlight from this episode that I did, and it has also stuck in my mind ever since the first time I watched it, which is the big build up.
Go ahead.
There's a big build up to giving this guy the memory stick, you know, a meeting in which it's very clear he's not going to be persuaded by anything other than absolute cast iron proof, goes away with the proof, then calls Sisko back for a meeting. And in that meeting, do you want to take it from here?
Well, he walks into the room and the guy just holds up the rod and says, "It's a fake."
It's so good.
Amazing brap the screen sort of moment. Wonderful.
Because there's just no preamble. There's no moustache twirling or you know, lulling him into full sense of security. It's just right off the bat, just instantly total dreams crushed, whole plan has fallen apart. It's absolutely in the worst trouble he could have been. Everything that could have, all his fears have come true just in one moment of like absolute venom. The guy's so fucking angry about it too.
I love how much they do with that character as well. Like, he's in two scenes. He arrives, he has a meeting with Cisco. He's a bit of a cowboy. He's kind of savvy to him. And you assume that you're going to get into some kind of game of trying to fool him. And that doesn't happen at all. He just immediately cops to it for reasons we'll soon understand. And it's one of those moments, you know, like some of the best moments in something like Breaking Bad, where you're just kind of like, it's just a gut punch, you know, it's them answering in English to get in on the bus in The Great Escape, you know, it's that kind of moment.
Yeah. I'm realizing that now my favorites all involve just moments of absolutely being crushed. Just like the viewer's hopes and dreams are shattered in a moment. But then, yeah, the sort of flourish on this, the kind of prestige at the end of the whole thing is Garrett just fucking kills him.
That's so the plan wild. All along, right? Yeah, Garrett never intended it for it to convince the senator. He just wanted it planted on the senator's person, then blow him up.
Yeah,
and that's
which gets them out of the recording authenticity issue as well, because it's sort of like, oh, the recording will be, you know, slightly damaged, and that will make it. Basically, it doesn't actually make it any more convincing as a fake, but the context in which the fake is discovered makes it them more willing to believe it. But yeah, he blows up the ship in such a way that it appears to have been the Dominion doing it.
And kills some creepy amphibian dude who helped them make the recording as well.
Yes, yeah. That's just thrown in at the end, isn't it? Oh, I suppose he's dead too. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. But at this point, Cisco's just, oh God, you know. And that guy as well. Well, I suppose that's...
Oh. Is he the guy who's like just some creepy sort of Halo machinima creator guy who's made their sort of rubbish? Yeah. The rubbish recording. Yeah.
Yes. It would have been hilarious if the recording actually was really shitty. It's just like low poly characters.
Yeah, and then at the end, sort of Avery Brooks, who's been bringing all of his incredible Shakespearean, you know, skills, full on monologuing at the camera in this episode, like Hamlet. And talking about how, you know, he's condoned forgery, bribery, and murder, and then says that he concludes that he can live with it. He says, "I don't.
Yeah.
The thing that's bothering me is that I'm not bothered by it." And then he erases the recording, and it's an extraordinary downbeat ending.
Yeah,
I wonder if this sort of breaks my rule about whether Starfleet shouldn't be compromised or the characters should be more symbolically good in that they approach problems in a kind of sensible way. And the problem being here, you know, I wonder what circumstances is it conscionable to commit total atrocity? And we find, I'm not sure that Cisco successfully finds the circumstances in which it's conscionable. He makes peace with it himself. I don't know that a satisfying morality is presented at the end of this in the way that other Star Trek episodes aspire to. But maybe that this sort of marks like a tipping point for Star Trek or the series in general, where it moves away from being sort of a projection of ideals to being more of a self-contained drama.
Well, it's a very interesting question, because I went into a big wiki wormhole with this show, and sort of reading about some of the controversies, there are a group, are they called Section 13 or Section 31?
Yeah.
Who are explicitly the sort of dark Federation, who kind of doing things like, you know, creating, you know, viruses that will kill entire species to win wars and all that sort of stuff. And I know at the time that was for exactly the reasons you're describing, Marsh, very controversial, because the Federation is supposed to be this force for good, not this force for genocide. And you're certainly right that subsequent Star Trek series have very much leaned into that one way or another. I haven't watched the Lower Decks thing, which is an animated show with a great premise. But just recently, there was some sort of hoo-ha on social media about an episode which was, you know, contained a sort of sexy sort of orgy joke scene, which people felt sort of stepped over some kind of line in how it portrayed Starfleet in this kind of Rick and Morty style disregard for, you know, convention, I guess. And that show is created and written by a Rick and Morty sort of veteran writer. But it's interesting to think about some of the more recent incarnations of Star Trek and how they've kind of wrestled with that or not.
Yeah, I just don't find it as interesting a premise. Like, it's exciting to me to see these characters encounter and resolve problems in good faith, like the best intentions. And it's like just super compelling because, you know, our universe, I mean, not Trek's, but our literal universe is super fucked up. And there are therefore many problems that can be discussed through allegory. And it's just enormously refreshing to see these problems unpicked by people who care about solving them well. And I think it's useful. And that's a service, I feel, that Star Trek has performed through the ages. And I don't think, I mean, New Trek's ambitions are different and they're not necessarily bad in themselves, but it's something that New Trek completely doesn't understand about the original Star Trek. They sort of see it as more of a vehicle for Abramsy bombast, and they just seem to find it interesting to solve problems, and they don't pit high minds or strong ideals against that challenge. Like, there is an interesting thing in the beginning of Discovery where it's sort of a neat idea where it suggests that the Federation, because of its sort of like idealism, is incapable of seeing that its peaceful assimilation of others is the very thing that the Klingons see as threatening. And that's a really kind of interesting kind of blind spot for, you know, a good organization characterized as being purely good to have. But I kind of feel like the more problematic or incompetent or just like outright corrupt they make the Federation, the less it can be used as this dramatic device for like a symbolic exponent, and it becomes just less able to solve these quandaries. And in Discovery, all the characters are fucking dumb and they just do dumb, terrible things, which are designed to propel the plot in heavingly idiotic directions for no obvious purpose, but then to fill screen time in an exciting way. And like, that's just that just doesn't compel me in the same way. I feel like it is interesting, and there are benefits to that in that I think New Trek is interested in like plot and characterization perhaps in a greater way than old Star Trek is. Like, it writes characters well, but its ideas just don't extend outside of that fiction.
Yeah,
I wonder if this is something you can speak to actually, Jamie, but like, I see a sort of trend in the kinds of fictions that are emerging right now where writers have sort of cut their teeth, maybe not on fan fiction, but in an era of fan fiction. And there's nothing wrong with fan fiction. It's obviously a great way to hone your skills and you can do great work. But like, it's inherently a process in which writers are sort of imagining themselves into an existing fiction. Like, they're kind of shrinking themselves to fit inside this box where the parameters are already defined. Whereas like, I feel like Trek in its heyday attracted writers with these kind of great cultural hinterlands, and they used that fiction then to look outward and explore kind of much larger problems than were contained in the reality of that fiction. I just don't think we get that as much because the writers today, whether that's just because of their capabilities or because it's in vogue, are just more interested in sort of like being saturated by the non-reality, the fiction that they're getting into, and they get really into like who feels what about who and what kind of exciting things can befall them within the context of that universe. But it doesn't try to speak to or approach larger ideas than exists in that world. Is it fair for me to tie that to fan fiction in any way?
I think it is. I think it's also it's something that is done by writers, and it's also very much something that's done by consumers as well. There's an appetite for it, which in the age of streaming has never been so strong. I think it's absolutely right what you're saying, and I think one of the issues with it, and if ever I talk about television, I always end up talking about this because for me it seems so fundamental, that in the early 90s when Deep Space Nine was first on the telly, you know, a show that did one murder over the course of a series, Murder One, was a hugely new and unusual thing to be done on network TV. And something like Twin Peaks, which, you know, didn't get round to revealing who done the murder until series two, again, hugely influential, but mostly an anomaly in an era where TV was either self-contained or very, very modular. And therefore, you were forced as a writer and you were forced as an audience to consume things which had a limited span. They had a limited scope and they had a limit to the space in which they had to tell a story. Now, Netflix won't let me watch a random episode of Deep Space Nine because they don't want me to have a discrete experience with an episode of television. They want me to sit down and watch a hopefully endless TV show where characters can just keep going for as long as people have their patience. And then everyone loses their patience and the show's cancelled. You know, that's kind of how it works. And so you lose that sense of internal logic. You know, Star Trek works because it heads to the stars in 45 minutes. it doesn't normally take, an 8-episode series like Picard did, which is this voyage into absolute nothingness. You know, they've got nothing to say. It's got, a lead actor who puts everything into the role and that just about saves it. And it's got a wonderful scene at the end with Data. But beyond that, whatever. And I think that is a really lost art across media. But I think Star Trek was often very good at it. Deep Space Nine, I think, is notable because it did turn into a serialized story, but it spent 5 series getting there and arranging itself to be in that place. So for me, that is the kind of fundamental problem, that no one knows the value of a discrete story anymore because it has lesser economic value. And so now we want to do, a kind of endless J.J. Abrams, sub-J.J. Abrams puzzle box nightmare where everyone's just got bottomless secrets until you run out of patience.
I think also, like, Deep Space Nine and this era of Star Trek maybe occupied an unusual place where it had huge financial backing and was mega successful. It was sort of maybe not guaranteed huge hit, but it was going to a guaranteed audience. And it was able, basically, they were just going to make a huge amount of it. There is a huge amount of Deep Space Nine. There's a huge amount of Next Generation. There's a huge amount of Voyager. And in the case of Deep Space Nine, that meant they kind of got to have their cake and eat it because they get to do the long serialized plot. And they also get to do just a whole bunch of one-offs as well that have, sometimes nothing to do with it. Sometimes there'll be hints of the overarching plot and sometimes just nothing at all. Like Whispers, I don't think the conference or whatever that he was sabotaging, I don't think we actually hear anything about that again. I think it's sort of it takes place in a broader context that may relate to the plot, but it doesn't actually move that plot forward, and it gets to be just a standalone episode that does its own thing. And they get to do loads of those, which I think kind of speaks to what you were saying, Marsh, about bringing in other writers and having them want to push this thing to be something it isn't currently and take it outside of the constraints. They get to do that, and they get to also tell a unfolding plot with mysteries and things they've set up a long time ago that will eventually end and have a resolution, just because there's so damn much of it. There's just like 7 seasons of 25 episodes or whatever it is. They have room to do all those things, and they have an audience who will watch it, and I think that's much harder to do now.
It's a shame. I miss that time, even though there was lots of very bad television in that time. You could look at the X-Files and look at how they fundamentally failed to do this. They couldn't. They oscillated between story of the week and purest nonsense, and it was, after a while, it just kind of consumed the show and ended up sort of obviating it, really. It's such a risk to take, but it does pay off, I think. And personally speaking, I would love to see kind of any show that isn't a kind of Inside Number Nine, sort of bottle episode specific anthology type thing, try and be a bit less serialized and a bit more story of the week, because it was the sort of it was a very fundamental model of television for a long time, which showed the Lone Ranger and the Fugitive and all that kind of stuff, where they would build their own logic. Admittedly, lots of bad television out of that, but also there's still life in that model of things. I found out that there was a new Star Trek show which tells a story of the week, I would just jump at a chance to watch that. Yeah.
I think it forces the writers to consider why they're telling the story that they're telling. In a, you know, if you have a very heavily serialized show, then the reason that anything happens is just causality. It's because something else happened before within the fiction. Whereas if you have a completely kind of standalone episode, then you actually have to consider why things are happening in a more isolated way. And I think that means that you end up just by gravity sort of having something to say. You know, why are we telling this particular story about the Bajorans, you know, recovering from colonization by the Cardassians? And that's because you end up, you know, making a reason for it. And that makes the episode stronger. Whereas I think now everything just sort of barrels along without really necessarily any kind of higher minded reason other than narrative consequence, you know?
Yes, and it's funny, something like Rick and Morty, I think, does serve that purpose for me, where often, you know, obviously that show has very toxic fans, which are kind of hard to get past, but like an episode of television that introduces a new idea, a new concept to existing characters and any, and then explores that to its fullest extent and then ends, you know, it's so hard to do, so almost no one bothers, but I'm always so hungry for something like that.
Yeah, sci-fi especially is such a good jumping off point to explore all kinds of ideas. Like that Next Gen episode springs to mind with the, I'm going to forget the actual nonsense words, but I want to say Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. Right. What is the actual, it's not Darmok because that's a character in Deep Space Nine. whatever it's called. Where they're trying to translate a language that only is written allusions to historical events, and therefore can't be translated, and trying to unpick that. And that's a kind of perfect like isolated episode where you just pick an idea and explore it and get to the bottom of it. And yeah, sci-fi just has so much scope for that.
And I think DS9 is the perfect blend because it manages to match that with, you know, with some kind of level of continuity and characters you do end up caring about over time. And even when it's in its kind of most heavily serialized form, you can still pick an episode and mostly it'll make kind of perfect internal sense and you'll still be equipped with everything you need to know to understand the stakes in that episode. I think that sort of becomes less true within like 10 episodes of the end, but otherwise it's pretty consistent, I think.
Yeah, that In the Pale Moonlight actually is a good example where that episode works in isolation, and it also significantly changes the story. Like the fact that their scheme to get the Romulans into the war works, and from then on, you know, I'm like more than 10 episodes later, and the Romulans being in the war is still a plot point that keeps coming up.
Yeah, that's a fantastic texture. I mean, like I say, I've got a baby arriving soon, so I probably don't have time to watch Deep Space Nine and play video games, but like you know, just how much fun that would be to be in those final few series, and there's so much texture and there's so much background and factions, and you know, it's almost Game of Thrones in space, you know, to a certain degree. Just, you know, I can just imagine as a from afar how much fun that is to be kind of, you know, fully immersed in that whole world. I guess we're kind of coming to the end now, but I just wanted to like talk a little bit about a couple of the cast members we haven't mentioned yet. I don't know how to pronounce his name. René Auberjonois, is that right? As Odo. That actor, I mean, he just recently died, didn't he? And just such an unusual character he's playing, and the sort of choices he's making about how he plays it, he manages to feel so alien and so human at the same time. I know I've said that before, but like, it's such a different character than something we've seen before in Star Trek, and he brings that sense of otherness to it so beautifully, I think.
Yeah, he gets to be like every Trek series has the logical character, right? They're, you know, whether it's a Vulcan or a robot or a Borg, and he is the closest we have to that, but he isn't cybernetic in any way, and he isn't from a species that's strictly logical. He just is a very sort of principled and kind of logical person. And yeah, in Whispers, he serves the role as the incorruptible one. But he gets to throughout play all of that with just, I've said this before, but more humanity and more personality than you can if your whole character beat is just, you're logical. He gets to both play that role and also have quirks and have personality.
I love the lore behind the changelings as well, that they've been sort of sent out. There was 100 of them, I think, that were sent out into the galaxy in various directions to kind of test people's reaction to them. I think that's a fascinating notion.
Yeah, doesn't it end up, I haven't got to the end in this rewatch, but doesn't it end up being the explanation for why all the races in Star Trek are humanoid? Aren't they all like based on the founders or something, or am I getting them mixed up with some other bit of Trek lore?
Wow, that's fascinating. Huge if true.
Huge if true. You maybe heard it here last. I did actually want to flag up, I only mentioned it briefly, that Odo eventually, you know, discovers that his species is the ruling class of the Dominion, which is a sort of multi-species empire in the Delta Quadrant, that is the main antagonist. And so that puts him in this very weird position where he is technically one of their, they're treated as gods by the races that they created to serve them. But of course he doesn't switch sides, and also he doesn't have any actual authority. He can't like order enemy troops around or anything. But it creates fascinating dynamics where there is a bit where the Dominion have allied with the Cardassians, and they are in power, and Odo is working for them. The Bajorans have a peace treaty with them so that they can still be on Deep Space Nine and serve, do their work, but with an uneasy tension with the sort of occupying forces. And Dukat is there as the Cardassian leader and hates Odo, hates the Bajorans, and wants to, this is his moment to like, you know, reassert his power and relive the old days. But he is sort of subservient to the to Weyoun, who is the Vorta, the kind of the diplomat race in the Dominion, who basically do all the leading because the shapeshifters don't give a shit and they just want it all to be handled. And of course, he is in awe of Odo and worships him and wants to do anything he wants. So Odo is like outranked by Dukat. It's like an authority triangle instead of a love triangle. Odo is outranked by Dukat. Dukat is outranked by Weyoun, and Weyoun is outranked by Odo. And they have these weird standoffs where Odo wants a favor and Dukat's like, absolutely not. And then Weyoun's like, absolutely yes. And it's completely unclear how the power dynamic is really going to shake out.
Yeah, Weyoun's another brilliant villain.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Is I've already raved about Dukat, but Weyoun's especially just a brilliant performance, and I love just this polite, smarmy,
silky.
Yes, silky is a good word. Because the Vorta are there as sort of diplomats and leaders, and they sort of try and see what deals they can make with the other species. And I really love polite villains. And Weyoun is an excellent polite villain. He's always just, all smiles and cunning. And yeah, Jeffrey Combs, I think, is the actor. Jeffrey Combs. And he plays it brilliantly. And it's really interesting in that Far Beyond the Stars episode, Dukat and Weyoun are in it out of makeup as racist cops. And they are both brilliant. It takes you a second to realize it's them. In fact, longer than a second. But they both play completely different roles or completely different personalities, maybe similar roles, but so well.
I think the lore behind that character as well is that their like head diplomat is always that guy. They just keep recreating that particular
really?
guy to fill that role and have done so for many years, which I like the idea of as well.
Yeah, because you meet other Vortas at times, and it makes you realize how much of it is Jeffrey Combs' performance, because the other ones aren't silky. They are, you know, they're still fulfilling the same role. They're still trying to make alliances and deals and stuff, but the others don't have that charm, and they come across as a lot more nasty and a lot more sort of alien. I also think we should mention Quark.
Secret weapon, I think, to DS9.
Yeah. It's such a broad character. When I was rewatching it, there were so many scenes where I would find myself completely on board and completely like interested in his stupid little capers. And then think about like the writing of this is not very good. Like he's really one note. He's just got this one thing, but he's performing it so well that I just am completely on board with it. And through that much makeup, it's amazing.
In the green room, Tom, you were talking about the ears incident.
Oh, God, yes. So I sort of have like a fondness for Quark in general, but he is a piece of shit. And there's, I don't know, there's like a way of having him be a piece of shit and it being fun. And there's a way of him being a piece of shit and it's not fun. And the one that's fun is, I remember there's an episode where I think Rom, it's O'Brien teaches Rom to unionize. Like they try and form like a union of workers to rise up against Quark's tyranny. And on Ferenginar, like union is a swear word. Like it's a absolutely, you can get arrested for even saying it. And Quark being a wildly anti-union guy who's horrified by the even mention of it is kind of fun because it's such a parody. It's such a, you know, we're all kind of in on the joke. The episode, I just watched a tiny bit of one this morning. Apparently I watched a lot this morning. And he's giving an employee evaluation to one of his waitresses and saying that she's, all the customers love her and she's nice to everybody except him. And she's like, I'm nice to you. And so, well, you could be nicer. And then basically tells her that she needs to read this manual on how to do a like erotic ear massage for Ferengi or he will fire her. It's like, holy shit, this is just grim. I don't like this at all.
It's funny because the Ferengi were the new villains in TNG, I think. In the first series of that, they turned.
Right.
They were going to be the sort of, yeah, the new Romulans, I guess. Before being quickly abandoned, I think, for being kind of icky and dubiously racially coded as well. I think there's some iffiness there. But I think Quark does a very good job of sort of obviating those issues, really, by just being such a big, silly character. I love that act. He's the actor also plays the principal in the first couple of series of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Armin Shimmerman, and gets most of the big laughs in those two series.
For any listeners who don't know, he's also Andrew Ryan in Bioshock, which is a trip. No, the first
way
time you learn it.
Yeah. Holy shit, that is...
I did not know that. Amazing.
Fucking okay, hell. For any hosts who didn't know that. Yeah, he's brilliant. He's another one who comes off really well in Far Beyond the Stars. He's interestingly the anti-racist white guy who is standing up for Cisco as Cisco's being discriminated against. And that's a really interesting role to, because it's not just the same actor. He is sort of doing Quark's voice, which I don't think is Armin Shimmerman's natural voice. I hope not. And so it's weird to sort of hear, just see like a really liberal Quark, basically. But out of makeup. What do you guys think of Dax?
I mean, she takes a lot of time to sort of become a character at all, I think. But when she does emerge, I still think she's probably one of the kind of thinner of the main cast.
There's a few characters who change significantly after the first season or two. One of which is Dax, because she was the science officer, and what they found is that Terry Farrell had a terrible time memorizing the jargon. Like she had a real hard time with that stuff. And also she just, I think her, like they jointly decided her strengths were not really in being the sort of reserved technical person. And so she becomes kind of a sort of swashbuckling, like, you know, lived many lives, salty sea dog kind of character who is going toe to toe with Worf and has a much more of like lust for life. And I think the character kind of comes into her own there. There's a great anecdote about one of the writers was saying he met Terry Farrell at a rap party one season, and she asked him what he did on the show, and he said, oh, I write that, I'm a technical consultant, so I write all that jargon you have to read. And she physically picked him up by his shoulders and pinned him against the wall and said, look, and explained to him, like, I assume she eventually put him on the ground to finish the rest of her explanation, but what she said was, look, if I'm like sitting at a terminal or I'm on my own in a scene, give me as much of that shit as you like, I'll memorize it. But if I'm talking to another actor and I've got to remember my blocking and focus on what they're doing and also figure out what I'm feeling and also remember all of your arbitrary bullshit words, that's hell. And he said it was one of the best notes he ever got. The other character that changes, I guess I should mention that Dax like physically changes as well in the last season where she has a new actor. Bashir, it starts as a very different character. I was really shocked when I started this rewatch. It was a long time ago that I actually started this rewatch. And Bashir is always, I remember him as my favorite character. And as I said, he was kind of my route into Star Trek. Like his friendship with O'Brien and also his friendship with Garak were two things that just made that series feel human and made me just like these characters and want to spend time with them in a way that I hadn't with Next Generation until that point. But he starts out awful. He's like, apparently their concept for the character is that he's sort of like a Casanova. He was like the, you know, extremely handsome, very confident ladies man. And he's just awful. Like when he flirts with Dax, he's just an absolute creep. And then they just change their mind about him eventually. And just like Alexander Siddig, the actor, hated that. He thought, that's just not me, and I can't really play it. And he was right. He can't. And also, you wouldn't want, even if someone was good at playing that, you just don't want that character. It's really creepy and unpleasant. And then he becomes a much more like compassionate and nice guy. Basically, Dax rejects him repeatedly, and he just gets the message eventually, and then stops doing that to anybody, which is a great improvement.
I love the episode where he realizes that his intelligence is genetically engineered. And like,
yeah,
what absolute actually, bummer that is to learn.
I need to. Do you remember what one that is? Because I've missed it on this rewatch somehow. I have been skipping some.
I do not. I do not remember. Back in the day when I watched it, I remember finding it very powerful.
Yeah, it's come up a lot since. Garrett gives him absolute hell for it. Like, it's obviously created a wedge between them because he's just like, oh, with your fucking computer brain, well done. He's really withering about it.
I mean, I do recommend anyone who's in for a wild ride, watch Our Man Bashir, the James Bond parody episode, because it is a wild ride. It's a good Bashir and Garrick episode as well, because Garrick is basically giving him shit for pretending to be a spy in his holodeck simulation.
Yes.
And that's excellent fun, actually, because, again, it kind of explores a very interesting idea about, like, you know, what a fantasy means to you and how much you should engage with it and how much you should, you know, treat it as trifling. And it actually, the way that episode resolves, which is very good, because Bashir, you know, Benjamin Sisko, who's playing the Bond villain, is about to like blow up the world. And Bashir just lets it happen, lets the sort of Bond film end in disaster, knowing that will give him the extra time needed for the techno jargon to save everyone. And it's quite a clever concept in the episode in that they've been blown up whilst being transported in the transporter beam. And the computer has deposited them in the holodeck and turned them into Bond villains. It's excellent, excellent fun. It's got
imagine
a great
the
moment.
Only way to save them.
Yeah, it's great because it's got a great moment where they're like, we don't have enough data to store them, to store their personalities. And someone goes like, the computer says that, and someone says, all right, what if we erase all the data on all the hard drives on the entirety of Deep Space Nine? Which they do. And that just filled me with such like, oh my God, file loss. Chilled, you know, it's like, oh no, is my script in there? Did I back it up to Google Drive? Yeah.
Is it so? Like, is that why they have to be Bond villains? Because they have to like store the personalities in the game?
Yeah, that's it. It's ridiculous. And funnily enough, in the thing that they used to send out to budding Deep Space Nine writers, they said, "No jokey holodeck not working episode. We all hate them." because they've done so many on TNG, and then they do one on Deep Space Nine, and it's a little marvel, actually. It should be excruciating, and even though they take far too many opportunities to get the women to talk vampily and dress in negligees, which is all a bit much, yeah, you still get Miles O'Brien with an eye patch and Benjamin Sisko literally getting to be like Blofeld and doing a speech about the end of the world and stuff. So
apparently that's the episode that turned the public around on Bashir. Like, they all hated him until that episode, and then they liked him after that.
I can just tell that someone looked at that guy and said, he's going to look good in a tuxedo. yeah. And I'm 100% sure that's where that episode proceeds from. Any other business, or shall we take our leave of Deep Space Nine?
I did want to loop back around. Nobody cares, but I realized I completely kind of dismissed TNG because I was talking about how I got into Star Trek. And like I say, it didn't make any impression on me initially, and neither did Deep Space Nine until Bashir and O'Brien. But once I got into Deep Space Nine, I then got into Next Generation and I got into Voyager 2. And I like all of them. Deep Space Nine is definitely my favorite. TNG is probably second, Voyager is last, but I think I like Voyager's captain the best, and I also like Voyager's doctor the best. I think those two characters are brilliant, and the rest of the cast are fucking dull, personally.
Yeah, what's that guy, Neelix? Is that weird guy?
Oh, God. God. It's not good.
No, Robert Picardo is the doctor, and yeah, Kate Mulgrew, what a brilliant, she's just an amazing actress. And
yeah, she's so good. Yeah. And she has some great, like, captain moments with a capital C, too. Like, there's an episode called The Void, where she's left in, like, they're stranded in this completely empty bit of space where there's no resources and everyone's trapped there. And she sort of goes out forging alliances in this way that even as a viewer, you're like, God, don't do that. Don't give up your precious resources and stuff. And it pays off in a really nice way where, I feel like that's the job of a captain in a show like this, is do the counterintuitive thing and have it pay off in a way that feels convincing and real and makes you think, shit, she should be captain and I should not. How do you guys feel about those series? Where do they rank?
I never really loved Voyager. I think that was the point at which I stopped watching Star Trek for a while.
I never even seen Enterprise.
Oh, I did. Oh, I watched a bit of Enterprise, but no, bad. But Voyager is interesting because I think actually it is quite the premise of it shows the weakness and the strength of DS9 in staying in one place, because you have the setup is similar in that you have a bunch of characters who have conflicting loyalties. There's I forget the name of the second in command in Voyager, but
Chakotay.
Chakotay, yeah. I mean, he's formerly a freedom fighter who is not aligned with the Federation. And then, under duress and in this new set of circumstances, he's kind of forced to become second in command to Janeway. And that should be like a conflict for him. But because it doesn't ever remain in one place there in this alien context, all of that, the consequence for that just gets lost very, very quickly. Yeah. And I think, if you compare that to the role that Kira plays throughout, it's much less nuanced or interesting as a result. And also, a lot of the episodes are just straight up bullshit. Like, oh no, yep. We've got stuck behind an event horizon. Let's shoot it, is the solution that they come to. Like, oh. Yeah.
I think after DS9 as well, there's something, it feels hard to come back to people on the bridge, and saying shields up and saying on screen and saying engage. I don't know. It just feels like you've done a lot of that, guys. You've done a lot of staring at the camera. And I think DS9 was so much more fun, even though like DS9 doesn't, the sense of place is very ambient. I think it's a kind of mood. You don't really get a sense of the architecture or the structures of it particularly. Which for some reason works incredibly well. Whereas like Voyager, like just the sort of wireframe of it, when you turn it on, you're just like, oh man, we're on the bridge and someone's going to say something and then someone else is going to say something and then they're going to have to put again. The shields up. Yeah.
I liked, I actually think the one thing they get out of the premise of Voyager is this finite aspect to it. Like they have a certain number of years that this is going to take. And so one of the things, it's a very gamey conceit, actually, that like for each adventure, one of the outcomes can be that it shaves years off their journey. Like they get some magic fuel that makes them go faster or something, or they hit an anomaly and they've got to take a detour and it's going to cost them, 6 months of their journey or something. The fact that there's this time as this persistent finite resource made some things more impactful or just gave it a sense of progress.
Yeah, I don't think it comes into play quite enough. Like that premise could be much more consequential than being marooned in a different star system, but ultimately becomes like just more of the same, really, an excuse to have more of the same that they had in the Next Generation.
Yeah.
Well, I could just imagine the writer's room as well. Like you've got this great concept and now you have to come up with 26 variations on how do we get home faster? And that is a long, long week.
DS9, like I don't really agree with the, criticism that making it static sort of doesn't mean it has momentum. The thing I like about it is that because it is a place, I guess the thing I don't believe is that making it static makes it the same each week, because to me, one of the great appeals of it that kind of makes me want to watch an episode of Deep Space Nine, for example, right now, is that you're just going to tune into this place and just see who shows up. And for me, that's more interesting than basically what you were saying, Jamie, of like the oh God, here we go, on the bridge again. Someone's going to say something. Like in DS9, it's like, okay, we're on the promenade. Who's just docked? Who has showed up to this place and is going to, you know, mess it up and create an interesting situation?
Yeah, it's like Cheers. It's just like anyone can walk into the bar, you know, and it's...
And in fact, it has a whole character who is a tribute to Cheers, doesn't it? Morn is a nod to Norm from Cheers, the guy who's always at the bar and quarks.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's fantastic.
I just watched, there's an episode called Who Mourns for Morn, which I guess the title is a bit of a spoiler. but that I recommend that one, actually. It's quite a fun little... It's like a film noir caper for Quark, basically. He gets embroiled in Morn's business.
I might have to watch that right now.
That's all the time we have for this episode. If you'd like to see these episodes as videos, for some reason, you can find them at youtube.creatingcrowbar. You can back us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/creatingcrowbar. Patreon backers are not charged for these lock-in episodes. It's just for our fortnightly gaming podcast. Or you can join us on Discord to chat with our lovely community. The link for that is on our website, creatingcrowbar.com. That's it. I've been Marsh Davis.
I've been Tom Francis.
I've been Jamie Britton.
Cheers. Do we have? I haven't done a lock-in for a long time. Do we do the thanks for listening thing or what?
Engage for listening, everybody.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Get the warp core.
Oh, God.